Before we jump into the challenge of conflicting changes in the monorepo, let's first settle on what a monorepo is. A monorepo is a single shared repository hosting all of a company's software assets. The advantages and disadvantages of a monorepo have been studied extensively in the software engineering community. Because of the overwhelming number of benefits, such as simplified dependency management, being able to push large platform changes in one go, improved code visibility, large number of companies such as Uber, Facebook, Google, and Twitter have adopted monorepos for software development in their respective organizations. The underlying argument about SubmitQ is that because of the rapid pace of development that happens in these monorepos, existing continuous integration workflows cannot guarantee a master that compiles, passes unit test, UI test, etc., all the checks that you care about. Because this is too hard to at scale. We refer to the state of the master, which passes all the unit tests, checks, etc., as a green master. Now, the goal of SubmitQ is to guarantee an always green master at scale. Here is an outline of my talk. First, I'll go over why green master is desirable for large companies and why guaranteeing that is hard. Then I'll go over two of the constructs that SubmitQ uses, namely probabilistic speculation and conflict analyzer, to see how SubmitQ uses them to tackle this problem. In the end, I'll go over some numbers from a production deployment. So let's begin by taking a dive into how a developer commits a change into the repository. So the repository is changing so fast, which means that the developer always has to sync his local workspace with the changes that are being made in the repository. Once he syncs his local workspace, he can start working on this feature. At a time when he is confident that his change is good enough for the organization, he publishes a patch. The patch is now picked up by a traditional continuous integration system, which runs the build, the unit test, etc., and then informs the developer if the change is good enough to land or not. At this point, another peer from the team can take a look into this change, check if it conforms to the style practices of the company, and then either approve or reject it. At this point, the developer can take this change and land it onto the repository. Now, you might observe that the change actually gets checked before it gets merged into the repository. Now, the question that might pop up in your mind is, okay, so why doesn't this not guarantee a green master? And to understand that, let's consider the following example. Let's say you have Alice and Bob working on completely independent features, C1 and C2. They publish these patches. The CI system actually picks up these changes, tests them on CI, informs the developers that these two changes independently are good enough to land. Alice and Bob commit their changes now. When Alice commits, everything is green, like, you know, everything is hunky-dory. But when Bob commits, the master becomes red, meaning that the master doesn't compile anymore. Now, you might think, okay, like, maybe this is a pathological case. Like, does this really happen in practice? And the answer is yes. So these are two code patches. I've modified them a little bit, but these are taken from our production deployment. These two patches actually pass all the checks individually, right? And if you look deep into these patches, the problem is that they both introduce the same variable name. They're changing different, they're introducing different features, but and they're operating on different sections of the same file, but because they are introducing the same variable name, the compiler doesn't know what that variable name needs to be associated with anymore. So as a result, the compilation fails and master breaks. And how often does this happen in practice? And the answer is it actually happens a lot. So what we did was we actually took commits that landed on the repository for a year and tried to compute what is the probability of a conflict, the chances of a conflict, a real conflict, as the number of concurrent and potentially conflicting changes increases. So what we observe is that the chances of a conflict actually increases from 5% all the way up to 40% as you have as the number of concurrent changes increases from 2 to 16. Let's take a step back to understand what this means. What this means is that when you have 12 concurrent changes, for example, that touch the same app or the same service, the 12th change has a 20% probability that it's going to break master. Now, this is a serious problem because what this, and we are dealing with hundreds of commits every hour, so the chances of a breakage now is like really high because even for 15 commits, it's as high as 40%. So before we try to understand how we solve this problem, let's take a step back to understand what are the drawbacks of a Red Master. With a Red Master, your rollouts are going to be delayed because you cannot release features from a Red Master because it doesn't compile anymore. It also hampers the productivity of developers because developers now do not know whether their change is failing because of the Red Master or because there is something inherently wrong with their change. Similarly, because you have to tag all your commits as either stable or not, your rollouts are complicated because you can only roll back to a version of the repository that actually is stable. So these are major problems, and for companies as big as Uber, this could result in like millions of dollars of loss, for example. So we now know that a green master is essential for large monorepo. Now the question is, how do we go about guaranteeing one? The simplest approach and the easiest approach is basically push all your changes into a queue. So in this case, Alice, Bob, and Carol push their changes into the queue. You can basically take the oldest change that came to your system, test it on the CIs, and if the change succeeds, land it, and now it becomes your new master. Similarly, if a change fails, you can reject it, for example. Now, this approach actually has some very nice properties. One is that it guarantees a green master by serializing changes. And by serializing changes, I mean it serializes the changes along with their build steps, not the serialization that source code management such as Git offers. But the biggest problem with this approach is that it does not scale to our needs of thousands of commits per day. Because a change can take as much as 3 hours to test, if you have 100 commits given hour, you're going to take forever to land these changes. So this obviously doesn't scale. Now you think about this, and you're saying, OK, I know how to improve the throughput of the system. I can go batch these changes. So in this case, for example, C1 and C2 are batched, tested on CI. And if the batch succeeds, like now the changes are landed. If the batch fails, you reject these changes. This approach has some nice properties as well. It improves the throughput of the system because more often, or especially if batches are expected to succeed more often than not. But it has two serious disadvantages. One is that because you're testing changes in a batch, you could have changes that fail intermediately. So you can have commits that actually are red when you land changes because you're testing changes in a batch. So you can have one commit in a batch that breaks certain test and another commit in the batch that actually fixes this test. So that is an issue. Apart from that, the bigger issue is that batches will often fail as the size of the batch grows. Because we observed earlier that as the number of concurrent changes increases, the chance of conflict increases. So batches will fail more often than not as the size of the batch increases. Now the question is, how do you deal with the failure of batches? One approach is you can reject the batch as a whole, but your developers are not going to be happy about it because they could say, hey, the batch failed not because of my change, but because of another person's change. So another approach is you can actually reduce the size of batch if a batch fails. But the problem is this incurs a lot of latency because more changes will get accumulated in the system, and at the next epoch, you will conform to using bigger batch sizes. So this approach also does not satisfy the needs of like scaling to thousands of commits per day. At this point, when we looked at all the approaches, we thought, okay, what are the two goals that our system needs to have to guarantee a green master at scale? And this is where we came up with these two goals, two separate goals. One was guaranteeing serializability of changes. And by serializability of changes, I mean serializability of changes in terms along with their build steps, not just changes that is guaranteed by, or patches that is guaranteed by underlying source code management systems such as Git. We also need to provide reasonable SLAs so that our developers are willing to trade speed for correctness. Can we combine these two goals and offer this at scale? And the answer is yes. This is precisely what SummitQ is. SummitQ uses three specific components to address this problem. One, the speculation engine that speculates on the success and failure of changes and builds a speculation graph. A conflict analyzer that tries to find if two changes are independent or not and uses that to commit changes in parallel. And a planner engine that orchestrates these components together to either commit or reject changes, prioritize builds that are most likely to succeed, et cetera. Let's first take a deep dive into what the speculation engine is. So every change in SummitQ, you might have observed that every change in SummitQ has two possible outcomes. One is that it can merge cleanly against master and pass all the build steps, Another is that it can actually break master. So the key idea is, can we pre-compute the outcome of committing concurrent changes under these different realities? So let's say we have three changes in the system, C1, C2, C3 that are pending. In order to commit C1, we need to run build B1 that runs the build steps for the head plus C1. Now this build has two possible outcomes. One is that it can succeed. If it succeeds, you can go and commit C1. Another is that it can actually fail. If it fails, you can reject C1. Now, what we can do is we can pre-compute the outcome of committing C2 under these two realities. So in one case, you can speculate that B1 is going to succeed and start running build B1-2, which essentially checks C2 against head plus C1. Similarly, you can also speculate that build B1 is going to fail and start running build B2 that essentially runs the build steps for head plus C2. So just to take a step back to understand what we are doing here, we are essentially pre-computing the outcome of committing C2 under two different realities. And based on the outcome of B1 and the outcomes of one of B2 and B1-2, we either decide to commit C2 or reject C2. Now we can take this one step further to come up with four possible builds in order to commit C3. We refer to this tree of potential builds as a speculation tree. One thing you might notice is that the speculation tree actually grows exponentially as the number of changes in your system increases. And when you have thousands of commits per day, you cannot obviously run 2 per 1,000 builds in parallel. So the question is, which set of builds do you run? The easiest approach that one can come up with is basically assume that every build has an equal probability to succeed and an equal probability to fail. So this approach essentially chooses builds in a breadth first order. So for example, it would choose B1 before choosing B1-2, before choosing B2, and so on. Now this approach has two major disadvantages. One is that, again, it doesn't scale to our needs of thousands of commits per day because you need to run 1,000 builds just to commit 10 changes. Another is that it leads to substantial waste of resources. Let's try to understand that with an example. So let's consider the following example. In this case, again, we have three changes, C1, C2, C3. We are running all these 7 builds in parallel, for example. Let's say build B1 actually succeeds. What this means is that we can actually commit C1, and we are going down the successful path of build B1 in the speculation tree. Now we are seeking the outcome of B1-2, which is testing C2 against head plus C1. Let's say this build fails. Now we reject C2, and we go down the failure path of B1-2 in the speculation tree. Now let's say at this point, we are seeking the outcome of B1-3, and let's say it succeeds. So we end up committing C3. Notice that even though we were running seven builds, the outcomes of only 3 builds were useful to commit these changes. So the observation that we can make is that if we can select and execute builds that are most likely to be needed, then we only require n builds out of 2 power n builds. Now the question is, okay, which n builds do I need to run so that I can use that to commit these changes? And to address this, we came up with the probabilistic speculation model. The idea behind this approach is that you associate every single build in the speculation tree with the probability that it's needed. For example, the probability that build B1 is needed is 1 because its outcome is always needed to commit or reject C1. Now, build B1, as we saw before, has two possible outcomes. It can either succeed or it can fail. And we can try to compute the probability that build B1 will succeed and the probability that build B1 will fail. Because build B1 is just running the build steps for head plus C1, the probability that it succeeds is essentially the probability that chain C1 succeeds against head. The probability of the negative path is just the inverse. Now we can use this to compute the probabilities of needing builds B1-2 and B2. Now let's take this one step further because it's much more interesting in that case. Now B1-2 is essentially running the build steps for head plus C1 plus C2. There are two possible reasons why it could fail. C2 can basically have some inherent issues, hence it doesn't pass all the tests, or it actually conflicts with C1. Thus, the probability that you go from between the builds B1-2 and B1-2-3 is essentially probability of success of C2 minus the probability of conflict between these changes C1 and C2. You can use this to compute the probabilities of needing build B1-2-3, for example. The exact details of the probabilistic model is present in the paper. Now to summarize, you can choose the most valuable builds by determining the probability of success of a change, as well as the probability of conflict between changes. Now the question is, okay, how do we come up with the probability of success of a change or probability of conflict between changes? And to answer this, we actually use machine learning. We use machine learning to build prediction models that can accurately predict probability of success of a change and probability of conflict between changes based on historical data. Our models have an accuracy of 97%, and the details of what sort of features we use can be, and the algorithm that we use can be found in the paper. So far, we assumed that all changes potentially conflict with each other. As a result of that, we couldn't commit changes in parallel. But we know that sometimes changes are not conflicting, are not conflicting with each other. For example, let's say you make a change to a README file and another person makes a change to an app. We know for sure that these two changes can never conflict with each other. So the question is, can we use this? And the answer is yes. If we can figure out two changes to be independent, then we can use them to, one, commit changes in parallel, two, trim the speculation space that we had. And the goal of the conflict analyzer is to find independent changes in the system and use them to do this. So let's look at the benefits of conflict analyzer again. Let's say you have three changes, C1, C2, C3. In this case, let's assume that C1 and C2 are independent from each other, and C3 potentially conflicts with C1 and C2. The speculation graph for these two builds, for these three changes, looks as follows. In order to commit C1, you need to run the build steps for C1 against the head. So you have build B1. C2 does not potentially conflict with C1, and it is independent of C1, which means you only need to run the build steps of C2 against the head, which is represented by the build B2. Now C3 potentially conflicts with both C1 and C2, hence it has to speculate on both these changes. Hence you have four possible outcomes, four possible builds for C3. So thus you can see that if you have the conflict graph, you can use that to commit changes C1 and C2 in parallel. Similarly, let's consider this other conflict graph where C2 and C3 are independent from each other, but they're potentially conflicting with C1. In this case, if you construct the speculation graph, what it looks like is you actually have only 5 builds now to consider instead of 7 builds. So again, it helps in trimming the speculation space and improving the likelihood of needing certain builds. So the question is, how do we actually detect these conflicts at scale? So in order to answer that, we actually use the build system. We rely on the build system to give us whether two changes are independent or potentially conflicting with each other. The code at large organizations is actually partitioned into smaller entities called targets. Every change affects a set of targets. And if two changes are affecting a disjoint set of targets, then it means that those two changes are independent. For example, consider the following example. Let's say you have this build graph, which has three targets, targets X, Y, and Z. When you apply change C1, you realize that targets X and Y were affected as a result of this change. Now, let's say you apply change C2, and you realize that it only affects target Z. Because these two changes are affecting different parts of the system, disjoint parts of the system, we know that these two changes are independent from each other. Now, there are some interesting examples, for example. In this case, when you apply change C2, you realize that change C2 not only affects target Z, but it also adds a dependency between target X and target Z. So just computing the intersection of change targets would mean that you would think that these two changes are independent, but in reality, it's not, because these two changes are actually potentially conflicting with each other. Now, the exact algorithm that we use to detect these conflicts at scale can be found in the paper. So let me give you a review of the SummitQ architecture. The changes are essentially submitted to an API service, which pushes these changes into a queue, a distributed queue. Now the changes are essentially pushed to the speculation engine, which starts building the speculation graph based on the output from the conflict analyzer. At every epoch, we have the planner engine that chooses the most valuable builds from the speculation engine and runs them using the build controller. Based on the outcomes of these builds, planner engine either commits or rejects changes. While evaluating SummitQ, we asked ourselves the following questions. How does SummitQ compare against the approaches that we had discussed earlier, such as the single queue approach, which just lands one change at a time, the speculate them all approach, which assumes that every build has equal probability to succeed and fail, and the optimistic approach, which basically speculates along the positive path. We also asked ourselves, what is the impact of conflict analyzer on SummitQ? In order to compare these approaches in a meaningful way, we also implemented an oracle that predicts correctly if a change will succeed or not, as well as it can detect whether two changes conflict with each other or not. Thus, the oracle has the best turnaround time, it has the highest throughput, etc. All the results that I'm presenting here have been normalized against the oracle. So in order to do these experiments, we actually ingested real changes into the system with different workloads. The only thing that we changed was the arrival timestamps of these changes. So the results are, we compared the approaches using under different workloads and different number of machines. So the x-axis here represents the number of workers, and the y-axis represents the number of changes per hour. We went from 100 changes per hour to 500 changes per hour. And the results are presented in a heat map. So let's first look at how speculate the model performs. Speculate the model approach, just to recap, essentially assumes that every build has equal probability to succeed and equal probability to fail. You can notice that the heat map is pretty much dark through the place. And under high contention, where you have more changes than the number of machines you have, it actually is 15 times lower than the oracle. However, observe that when you have less contention, meaning you have more workers than the number of commits per hour, speculative model approach actually performs reasonably well. Now let's compare that against the optimistic speculation approach. Just to recap, the optimistic speculation approach essentially speculates along the positive path. You can observe that optimistic speculation actually performs better than speculative model approach. And the intuition here is that most of the changes in the system are actually expected to succeed. So speculating deep actually is much more helpful than speculating wide. Now let's look at how SummitQ compares against these approaches. As you can notice, SummitQ actually performs really well compared to these approaches. Under low contention, it pretty much matches the performance of the oracle. So SummitQ matches the performance of Oracle under low contention. So what I showed you earlier was all the 50th percentile latencies. Now you might think, okay, how about 99th percentile latency? And for that, this heat map presents you those results. What you can observe is that even under extremely high contention, SummitQ is only slower than the Oracle by 4x for the 99th percentile, essentially. Typically, we don't operate at that rate in production. We generally tweak the number of machines so that we generally operate between 1 to 2x overheads. Like I mentioned, we also wanted to investigate what is the impact of conflict analyzer on the different approaches. What we observe here is that Oracle's turnaround times improve by as much as 50% as a result of conflict analyzer. Both SummitQ and speculative model approaches benefit heavily, but they are not close to the Oracle. But as the contention decreases, the benefit that you get out of these approaches more or less converges with the Oracle's benefits. To summarize, SummitQ guarantees an always green master using two techniques, namely probabilistic speculation and conflict analyzer. SummitQ has been used in production for a couple of years by 2,000 engineers at Uber, and it works really well at scale. Thank you.
We're a little behind schedule, so we have time for one talk, one question while the next speaker gets ready. Are there any questions?
The question I had was, presumably there are conflicts not just in the compilation, but also in execution of tests. And it would seem like your conflict analyzer.
Because even the test targets, so what it does essentially is it actually trickles the affected targets, right? So let's say a test target depends on a compilation target, a build target, right? So.
That was basically my question.
Fair enough.
Okay.
Thank you.
Let's thank our speaker again. Our next speaker.